when Mark and asked me to would I be interested in coming and talking about legal advocacy as a tool for social change, this is a subject that I have thought about. I mean, this is the reason I went to law school. Okay, in the 1960s, most of us remember the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. But I went to law school to get the legal skills so that I could be a lawyer involved with legal and use those skills for social change. I went there after, like President Obama. I too was a community organizer. Didn't become the president. But I too was a community organizer in the 60s in a number of different contexts. So I sort of blend. And the reason I went to law school was because I realized I didn't have the temperament, I didn't have the patience to be a good community organizer. That my personal skills were much more focused in terms of what I could do. Now, we're 40 years beyond my going to law school, 41. And I think I'm a probably better community organizer now than ever I was in the 60s. And I think I appreciate and respect the community organizing and much, much more than I did in the 60s. And I also think, and the point I want you to hear, the point, is that legal advocacy, to be effective, must be only one tool in a whole arsenal of change strategies. I think you're going to hear a little bit later in the afternoon from Linda Anthony when she comes about direct action. You're going to hear about political kinds of action, administrative type of action. Legal lawsuits should be considered exclusively as part of one small part. I'm going to focus on national disability stuff. But there's a whole bunch of history that we have in terms of the law and social action that it's very, I think, very educational for us, and we haven't learned the lesson. We have not learned the lessons. How many of you guys have ever heard of the group ACT UP? Right? This is an amazing group. Right? AIDS comes in the 60s, hits us with a 2x4 over our heads. And very quickly thereafter, a group called ACT UP hits the streets. And what they were doing, they weren't thinking lawsuits, right? They were not thinking lawsuits. They understood, and very similar kinds of stuff that we face in disability, in terms of stigma, in terms of building a constituency, in terms of a lot of other stuff, that the way to get money and social change was from grassroots direct action. And that's what was ACT UP's mantra. They did bring some lawsuits, but they all occurred after the fact, after they had established some context and nationally for their social action, after the politicos involved knew that if they didn't deal with ACT UP, they would be visited in their homes, in their churches, you know, and the civil disobedience would occur all over the place. So when a lawsuit came, it wasn't out of the blue. It wasn't out of the sky. Let me talk to you about another group. We really have not learned, I don't think that. This is obviously just my opinion. Nothing written in stone. From other groups, how many of you guys remember the Welfare Rights Organization? Well, WRO was, I was working with WRO in the 60s. In the 60s, before legal services, basically, welfare rights movement in this country, made up mostly of women and mothers, to increase welfare grants to increase benefits for people on welfare. This is before the president in 95 eviscerated welfare. But and what they were doing, in a way similar, but not as grassrootsy, not as confrontational as ACT UP, but they were organizing welfare mothers. They were doing some direct action, but they were doing lots of other things as well. Let me suggest that one reason most people in this room, who I know are ages, guys, most people in this room should have, when I said no, welfare rights organizations should have, sure. And the reason it died, WRO, was because sometime between 1969 and 1972, 73, thereabouts, the lawyers took over. The lawyers convinced the welfare mothers and the welfare WRO members that litigation was the way to create social change. And the result was that the movement that had begun in the 60s, I think, the movement that had begun in the 60s and was beginning to, you could see, we had a terrific chapter in Pittsburgh, right? I can't remember the woman's name, but we also had incredible chapters in a lot of places in Pennsylvania, right? That when Governor Schaaf, you know, or his predecessor, you know, was, you know, when we talked about welfare grants, it wasn't because of litigation in the 60s, it was because these mothers were going to be in your face. The lawyers took over, and the participants said the first, when they had a problem in 1970 and 71, the first thing they said was, lawyer, sue them. And the lawyers, including yours truly, said, because bringing litigation is really incredibly a lot of fun, or at least it was. And it's a lot more difficult, as Mark correctly said, in the last 10 years. But it was a high. I mean, gosh, whose name was in the newspaper because of the lawsuit? Our names, the lawyers, not the plaintiffs, not the organizations behind it. You know, it was incredible high. And when you win, it's even more of a high. The same thing happens. But it's very disempowering to the people when the first option, and I think the difference between ACT UP and welfare rights organizations is a really good one. Let me suggest another organization or issue that we have not learned from, but it has had a major impact on us. The abortion versus the anti-abortion movements. Okay? I don't care what side you're on. But from a just the point of view of social change, right? The abortion movement basically never had a grassroots movement, and it's a hard group to organize, right? But they had lots of lawsuits, and the counter groups, the anti-abortion, they developed the movement. My wife, who is a pediatrician, who had an office in Northeast Philadelphia, every Saturday she was saying, God, it was so unpleasant, just walking from her car to the, you know, it wasn't there were pro-abortion people out there demonstrating in front of the clinic, it was anti-abortion, because the pro-abortion people said, let's bring a lawsuit. And there are real consequences and limitations because of that. Given all that, let me talk about some real successes that we've had in disability stuff with both movement in the country and lawsuits combined. And I can't, the only principle I want you to get out of this, the principle, is that the lawsuit should be a part of a broader strategy, a broader movement. And it should not be the first, second, or third option. You know, it's one thing if number one, two, and three don't succeed, and then maybe, you know, you're stuck with us lawyers and lawsuits. But it should be the first option. And it frequently is, and guys, I'm as guilty of it as all of us, right? Let me tell you about successful stuff that has been happening all over the country. And there has been some great great lawsuits. There have been some great movements occurring. Let me give you, in the disability context, an area that I'm areas that I'm particularly knowledgeable about. The first thing is transportation. If one looks back, and Mark's comment about someone writing a history of the disability movement is a great one. I mean, we really don't have. If I asked you in this room, what action, what year was the most important in the last 40 in disability in this country, what would people say in this room? Now, you guys are in the disability movement, okay? But there's clearly one critical action and one critical movement. 1977, what happened? Well, we lived through Watergate. We have Gerald Ford act as sort of the president. I can't remember who the secretary of HHS was, or it wasn't HHS, it was HEW, right? And in 1973, what happened, guys? What is so critical about 1973 for us?
The Rehab Act
was enacted, that's right. Now, this is another good example of something coming out of a nun movement. And the Rehab Act, the Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, is 40 words. Put in by then Senator Humphrey and a few other people. But it did not come out of a massive grass movement, right? As did the Civil Rights Act in 1965, you know, that enacted the civil rights based on race. That came out of a movement, and the movement started well before Rosa Parks. I mean, the 30s and the 40s, there were lots of movement. So that when you finally, and then you had the Brown versus Board, by the time you hit 1965, it was almost inevitable because the country did not want to see more, could not take, would not take, you know, more kinds of actions that were occurring, more kinds of laws, blah, blah, blah. So that the law became sort of much more reasonable. 1973, we didn't have that. 1973, let me suggest that the Section 504 of the Rehab Act was an act of charity. There was an act of, I don't want to say quite pity, but going in that direction. It was not the result of a grassroots movement saying, give us our rights. You know, give us our rights. It was an afterthought, right? So what happens with an afterthought, right? The statute is 40 some words, guys. Not enough to tell anybody, any agency, what they have to do or what they can't do, even though as lawyers, I mean, we are great at spinning spinning something out of something, right? But we do that, you know. But here in 1976, at the end of the Ford administration, federal regulations had been, the process of writing the federal regulations for 504. And for those of you who don't know, the heart and the meat of Section 504 is in those rights. Okay, that's the heart and the meat. The regs were promulgated, were written, but Ford and his secretary of HEW refused, Secretary Matthews, thank you, I don't even remember, refused to promulgate them. Okay, 1976, new election, right? Election occurs, Jimmy Carter gets elected, Joe Califano becomes Secretary of HEW. Disability community meets with him. We gotta get these regulations out. I mean, because the ordinance is totally unimplementable, 45 words. Lawsuits were brought to implement them, big deal. You know, the federal government said, you know, it's like a mosquito, a lawsuit, you know, slap it away. And they can, and the courts, even in the 70s, defer. What changed it was throughout the country, in every HEW office in 77, it might have been 1976, thereabouts, every single office throughout the country, disability advocates sat in and said, we're not leaving until you implement the regs. Well, in most of the offices, I don't know, 8 or 10, I don't know how many there were in the country at that time. You know, after a day, a few hours, people left. In one office, they did not. San Francisco disability community stayed in that office for 30 some days. Okay? And the press starts looking, what the heck's going on here? Right? And the other supporters of the welfare, and there wasn't a welfare rights movement. You know, Berkeley sure had the mecca of the disability, but it wasn't a movement, right? But the unions started supporting them. The non-union people and, you know, family members would go in. You know, you didn't have showers. You didn't have adequate toilet. You had no way to get food, and you saw photos of people bringing food up in buckets outside and through the windows. So you had a movement, a focus. That's what happened. The regs become implemented, and then the question becomes, okay, let's enforce them. And that's when all the problems became. Because after the movement fell apart in 1977, it stopped. So what happened? You had federal agencies, transportation, housing. You had the HEW regs, but that's it. You didn't have any other federal agency regulations. And the movement wasn't such that they were going to be able to go in and do that in every single federal agency to promulgate the regs. So now we have various lawsuits and movements occurring in the 80s. And some of them were very, very effective. I mean, I started by giving you the background on transportation. Transportation, this afternoon you're going to hear from Linda Anthony, who's at another meeting right now. But the national group called ADAPT. You know, ADAPT started around transportation. ADAPT used to be known, I can never get the name right, but Americans Disabled for Accessible Public Transportation. That was what ADAPT was. Right now it's just ADAPT. It doesn't mean anything. But in the 1980s, what they were doing twice a year, they were bringing, you know, they brought lawsuits, but they were always in the streets. The organization, trade organization of public transportation authorities. I think it's called APTA, I may be wrong. American Public Transportation Authorities, I don't know. But whenever they would meet twice a year to have fun, ADAPT was in their face. And there were actions occurring. And this is the way, so that by the time a lawsuit is brought in the mid-80s against the Secretary of Transportation, whatever it is, Secretary of Transportation, for failure to promulgate the Section 504 regs, 15 years after Congress acted, guys, right? The lawsuit was not in a context. Everyone knew, Department of Transportation people knew, because ADAPT was not only going after APTA at their conventions, was going after the Secretary of Transportation. The same thing occurred in housing. You know when HUD finally promulgated its Section 504 regulations from a statute passed in 1973? 1988. Guys, that's amazing, right? I mean, can you imagine, it's just a reflection of the powerlessness, or the relatively powerlessness, that both the enemies perceived that we had, and in fact, how little power we had. There were two lawsuits brought in the 1980s against HUD to try to force them to promulgate regulations, right? But, it wasn't until then Secretary of HUD, there was some, but I remember this seeing in the 80s, the Secretary of HUD going and trying to speak, and in the back where, like a big place like this, except bigger kind of stuff, 20 people in wheelchairs screaming, pass the regulations, pass, this poor guy, wherever he went, right? So the lawsuit was a part of it. The lawsuit was, if we lived in a non-political or apolitical judicial context, the lawsuit's a slam dunk. It's a lawsuit 1975 wins, right? The federal, when Congress passes a law, the agencies are required to promulgate regulations, right? One does not have to bring a lawsuit to make them promulgate the regulation. But there are counter forces that clearly were existing that made for, that was the context in which the actions and the lawsuits occurred. Even after you finally get USDOT and US HUD to promulgate their regulations, what happened, guys? What happened? How many in the towns and the townships where you all live, one requirement. Go ahead, what?
I'm just taking a stab in the dark.
Go ahead.
But I'm guessing that the distance between the politicians and bureaucrats at the policy level and actual implementation would basically say that
it was a Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
Go ahead, say it again. You're right on the money.
Basically, the distance between the bureaucrats and the policymakers and the actual people and implementation is so large that it just takes forever for things to actually come together.
Let's take it in the context of just housing. The simplest part of the housing part of HUD. HUD said in 1988 in its regulations, right, that and let me tell you, the regulations went through so many versions beginning in 1980 or something. You know, the simplest thing, that all new construction that received federal financial assistance, housing money, okay, all new housing construction that received had to have the following was required, or else it would be discrimination under Section 504. One, 5% of the newly constructed units had to be accessible to people with physical disabilities. And another 1% had to be accessible for each of people with hearing impairment and for visual impairment. 1988. When do you think that, and how do you think, and why do you think that finally began to be implemented? You're my expert. Wait a minute, you gotta wait for the mic.
In Dauphin County, the construction just started to be open to residents with actual physical, the construction with apartments and units for people that are accessible for people with physical disabilities. They just started being leased, and they were finished being constructed a couple months ago. So I can speak to Dauphin County,
County reflects the country. Okay, and what Dauphin County, what you don't realize, is that it took. I mean, one would think, I'm not kidding when I say the regulation, the way I just said it, is as clear as I just stated. Right, this is. I'm not going to get at the difficult part of the regulation of that substantial rehabilitation that has to be like this. I'm not going to talk about all the other gray things. Just the simple new construction. We all know what that is. Right? That's not a rocket science term. You know, you're building a new place, then 5% of those units have to be accessible. It took in the 1990s both street action, demonstrations, and primarily was ADAPT and lawsuits, right? But the lawsuits clearly were after the context of the 1980s and the promulgating the regulations, and the lawsuits were clearly in the context, and I think that boat has been turned around. One of the things that the disability community, in terms of its lawsuits, have always said, it's like turning the Queen Elizabeth. We're tugboats, or a tugboat. Maybe if we're lucky, we have a few tugboats. But we're trying to turn the Queen Elizabeth around, that humongous thing, with lawsuits, with its direct action. I think in the housing context, we have finally begun. Okay, so you're talking 1973 to 2003. You know, it took 30 years, but I really do believe that we're going to have at least for federally financed, right? Because that's what 504 applies to. We're going to have before we all die, a large number of accessible units. So this issue should not require further litigation. Now, the Federal Fair Housing Act, another disability statute promulgated in 1988, very clear, saying all new construction after 1991, there I may be off, had to have, and it defines accessibility. Well, guys, if I told you we are still bringing lawsuits 2009 against developers who are building, this is not, every architect knows the Federal Fair Housing Act has this requirement. Every architect. My assumption is every developer knows it as well. Why are we still suing to get to see? I mean, it's like, these are not exciting lawsuits either, guys. Right? I gotta tell you, these are really boring lawsuits. But we have to bring them. Right, because tomorrow morning I'm going down to Newark, Delaware, because a woman in a fancy condominium, not a cheap one, a fancy one. I bet you they spent $400,000 buying that thing in Newark. Can't get in unless she goes through the parking lot, the parking garage, to her place. Why she bought it like that, I don't know. But the idea of having to bring lawsuits on stuff that is so clear in 2009 says to me that where we're failing is in the grassroots. Where we're failing is, sure, I'm bringing a lawsuit, but we don't have a movement, right? And this afternoon, I think Linda's going to get into this much more when she talks about the ADAPT pitchfork, but it requires, we do not have an ADA, right? We have an AMRDA, we have an AMIDA, we have an A, and it can go on, right? An ABDA, an AHHDA, right? But there is no cross disability, movement. Right? We're 54 million people in this country, right? The most recent census that did an update in 2005, when even defining severe disability, it's still 34 million. But it's a humongous number. Can you imagine what this would do if we really had any level of consciousness about a movement? We wouldn't be talking about implementing Olmstead. We'd roll right over them. Okay. Let me tell you the other area. So housing, we've been successful all over the country. But there are still, extraordinarily as it may sound, we've been in large part successful in the main fleet kinds of transportation stuff, the buses, the trolleys, blah, blah, they are all fully accessible. And the reason isn't because of the transportation authorities. The reason is because they're being constructed that way. They're designed and constructed that way, and then therefore that's all you can buy, right, if you're a transportation authority. Where we haven't been quite as successful is on paratransit. And we're still fighting the battle of paratransit. But paratransit, at least for me, step on a sacred cow, which we faced in Philadelphia. When in the 80s, I was involved with then Disabled in Action of Philadelphia. I'll never forget the guy, Steve Margolis was the president in Philly then. And I had very little contact with disability stuff, et cetera. And he said, we need a multimodal accessible transportation system. The ADA passes. The ADA requires certain, you know, all new buses, all new blah, 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 be accessible, because the ADA is prospective. And it said, and also provide for a paratransportation system for those people who could not use the main fleet, you know, buses and stuff. Didn't get to you guys in the rural areas, you know, who are stuck in the houses because there are no buses, public transportation, and therefore, if you can't drive a car, you're really stuck. ADA didn't touch that, didn't go near that. Okay, so now the example, and it's not just Philadelphia, but Philadelphia is the one I'll never forget some of the phone calls I got. Philadelphia in 2005, 2006 finally got 100% of its bus system fully accessible for people with physical disabilities. It's also fully accessible for people with hearing impairment because it has a computer thing saying what the next stops are. Okay? I start getting, so what does SEPTA do, our Public Transportation Authority? It starts saying to people, you don't need to ride on paratransit. We got an accessible bus system, right? Now, part of the problem with being disabled is that a lot of us begin to think we really cannot do certain things, like ride regular buses. Why? Never done it before. Why? Buses weren't accessible. I was too frightened. I didn't know how to do it. So now SEPTA says, well, and it's not just SEPTA, all over the country. Because part of it is changing not just the culture of the agency, but changing our culture to accept the fact that we really can do a lot more things than we ever thought we could, right? So I start getting the phone calls, I'm sure Mark, I know Mark, and did too, with disabled people saying, oh, aren't you going to sue them? They're cutting me back on my paratransit. I said, what do you mean? Well, they've only given me something called conditional eligibility. Now, mind you, when the ADA was passed, paratransit was supposed to be a supplement to the main fleet, right? It wasn't an entitlement to paratransit. It was an entitlement to transportation. And if your buses were not accessible, then the public transportation authority had to have another system that would give you equal opportunity. And the equal opportunity was manifested in the paratransit. So people started calling out, aren't you going to sue them? They're cutting me back. I said, well, why don't you use the buses? Well, I've never done it. Or, it's awfully far. I'll never forget the one woman who lived in far northeast Philadelphia, and she wanted to go to the concert downtown. It's awfully far. I have to take three buses to get there, as opposed to one paratransit. I said to her, what does your neighbor do? Your non-disabled neighbor. How does he or she get to the concert? Well, she takes the three buses. I said, that's what equal opportunity is. I'm sorry you live way out there. And obviously, non-disabled people may have the other option of driving, you know. But equally low-income people, that's what we're talking about. So that fight's far from over. But I think we've turned the corner on transportation. Now let me get to the one issue that has been the most contentious. And it's really fascinating. The Institute at Olmsted. One of the problems with Olmsted, and I am the major villain in the country, the major villain. I will never ADAPT decided in 19, they won the transportation war, right? The ADA was passed. So in 1991 and 1992, they changed its name from what I told you to just ADAPT. And they decided to focus on getting people out of institutions. Getting people out of it. They started to focus getting people out of institutions, right? And I will never forget in Philadelphia, The ADAPT chapter / Disabled in Action called me into their office and said, we won a lawsuit to get people out. Now this is way before in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania there was really any street action. There was really any grassroots movement to, you know, get to the governor, get to the secretary, get to blah, blah, blah.
Right.
We had, because of Eileen, primarily, we had an Act 150 in 1988. Eileen and I bring a lawsuit on behalf of one person, Mr. Williams, something like that, in 1991 or thereabouts, you know, who wanted some kind of services. But I said, sure. Rather than say to them, which is what I have done with community, with groups in the past, and I do with groups in different parts of the country now, instead of saying to them, I'll bring the lawsuit after you do 6 months of direct action. I'll bring the lawsuit, which I should have said, only after a year worth of meeting with the legislatures and making your case. After meeting with the media people and making your case, so that the lawsuit would become part of a movement. Instead of that, yours truly said, sure. We brought a lawsuit and we won. And the second lawsuit under this legal theory was Olmstead, right? And you know, someone interviewed me recently and said, well, what did I have to do? Well, I sent to the lawyers in Georgia our briefs. You know, and they used our briefs in the circuit court, you know, and now 1999, the Supreme Court takes the case, and there still is no movement. Let me qualify that. There has been a movement in terms of MRDD since the 70s, right? It waxes and wanes. But there has been a movement. And the Pennhurst lawsuits and those other lawsuits were part of that movement, right? But here, the Olmstead looked at, first of all, as we all know, Olmstead applies to state centers, applies to large ICS, applies to any institution where people live, right? But it was clearly focused on people, well, Olmstead was focused on people in the state hospital for mentally ill. The preceding suit that I brought to Helen L. was someone in the Philadelphia nursing home, right? So now we've gone beyond the MRDD institution context. But what we never ever had any place in the country, we still don't have, is a cross-institutional base strategy. I mean, can you imagine if the MRDD community, if the MI community, if the PD community really believed there was an ADA in terms of this state? Can you imagine what if, you know, a lot of what we do in terms of grassroots, we don't say outside of this room, but it's smoke and mirrors. You know, 30 people looks like a lot in wheelchairs, and it is a lot. 50 people looks like, and it is a lot, right? But can you imagine 200? Right? And if the MI community brought 35, 40 people, and the MR community brought 35, 40 people, and the PD community, you know, then you say, whoa, this is a mess, right? So if you were secretary, if you were the governor, Rendell, and you had 200 people in front of your house out in, not Roxborough, but wherever he was out there, or in front of your place here, or if you were Secretary Richmond, and you said no more money to institutions, right? Not nursing home institutions, not MR institutions, but institutions, right? This gentleman asked about the Olmstead plan, or plans, as the case may be. All over the country, that issue is paramount because there are no real plans. Right, and so now we're coming across the 10th anniversary. The interesting thing about successes of lawsuits all over the country in terms of Olmstead, right, is that we've made enormous progress. Guys, I want you to see, we have made enormous progress in the MRDD world. right? We now have 6-7 states that have zero state institutions, right? We have another 5 or 6 states that have less than, spend less than 5-6% of their long-term money on MR in institutions. They're gonna fold. You know, Pennsylvania, we still have lots, right? You know, we're still way up. But there have been decreases every year. And I think pretty much, I hope, in our lifetime, we will see it almost down to zero. Because as long as you close the front door, you know, it becomes more and more expensive. But when you bring a lawsuit, guys, let us be very, very clear. There, and Mark pointed out, there has been more and more opposition. Who are the opponents to closing down state institutions? The state MR institution. What? Well, unions, that's right. The unions are the number one. There's another opposition in the MR. Sir, in the back.
Families who've been told that's where their kids belong.
Right, the voices of the retarded. The families have been taught that's where they belong. Yes?
You also have the older people that don't admit that they can go do it anymore, so they're going to go into nursing home.
Well, we get to nursing home. Nursing home has a different enemy. But first is MRDD, but yeah, clearly the state institutions, it's the unions, it's that. But then we also have private, for-profit, there's a great myth around in terms of the ICFs that there's something called non-profits. Let me explain to you what a non-profit is in this, as opposed to a profit ICF-MR. Well, a profit ICF-MR, the owner, / executive director can make $200,000, $300,000 a year. Okay? He's the owner, says his own salary. A nonprofit ICFMR, the executive director can make $200,000, $300,000 a year. Oh, same amount of money. Right? Why? Because he gets his board of she gets her board of directors, the nonprofit, to pay the salary. There's virtually, in terms of looking at them, no different. And what keeps both of them going? Money. If disabled people realize that they are the cash cows, right, for one industry after another. Now let's look at nursing homes. The thing that has been truly mind-boggling to me, truly, 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 on my tombstone, they're going to say, Steve Gold was mind-boggled because, and I'm going to say the following. After 1999, Mark is absolutely, his reading, the only reason we've even gotten this far with Olmstead, you know, if you read the Olmstead decision, the Supreme Court would never, ever have done that for people of color. Even though in Brown versus Board of Ed, they did say it with all deliberate speed. And they never, ever would have set up for women under Title IX. Even though Title IX, they did. The courts are conservative institutions. They don't. You never really win. You sort of win. And sometimes you barely win. Okay. So that what happened in when the Olmstead decision came down, I will never ever forget it. ADAPT was having an action in Washington. We got the decision. I read it. I almost was in tears. Almost in tears, saying, with all the provisos and all the equivocations that the court said, on one hand they said yes, unnecessary segregation is a form of discrimination. On the other hand, it said, they can have a plan. As long as it's moving, whatever that means, I'm thinking Brown versus Board of Ed, and it said, you've also got to see how the state spending all the rest of its money. I said, why? It's discrimination based on disability. Why have to see how it's spending its other money? Who cares? Right? So here I am, almost in tears, and the national organizer for ADAPT says to me, I never, ever will forget this. He said, you cannot say that. We have to win, say we won, tell the world we won. So we get on the television and press and we say, what an incredible major victory this is. And we go all around saying, what an incredible victory this is. And I'm there always with my fingers crossed behind me saying, yeah, what an, right. And so what we did is we pulled victory from the mouth, not of a defeat, but not from the mouth of a total victory either. But for 2000 and 2001, we were invited around the country, and we were going around the country like you know, a bull in a china shop, encouraging every independent living center, every DD council, every blah, 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 you know, get the people out, get the people out. This is a major victory. Do you know how many lawsuits have been brought based on Olmsted to get people out of nursing homes between 1999 and 2008? In the country, less than 10. Nothing, right? And some of them were not even, some of them were actually, which actually very clever lawsuits, were not class actions. Several in Illinois. So then you ask the question, well, wait a minute, why? I mean, here you got a lawsuit victory, quote unquote victory, that gives you at least some handles. Why aren't they bringing these all over the country? Well, let me go back to the point. You know, unless there is a political movement of disabled people demanding that these be brought, they're not brought. You know, I mean, I've gotten in a lot of trouble with two groups that I really do like and respect a lot, but I've gotten in trouble when I'm critical of them, right? The independent living centers have totally dropped the ball, right? They are not going into nursing homes, getting people out and demanding that their lawyers bring the lawsuits to get people out. And they're the ones in the nursing homes. You know, the DD Council, the ARCs, the ARC has been incredibly successful in this country. Paul Marchand and the National ARC people, all over the country, they understand how to build a movement. They have built movements in almost every state, right? So that when you say visions, you know, for equality and ARC, et cetera, do their stuff in the Capitol once or twice a year, that's part of their movement. You know, they are a presence, right? You don't see it in the nursing home context. And the nursing home context, the woman over here, we talked about, who are the enemies? You were right about the unions. Who are the enemies in the nursing homes? Yes?
Drug companies?
Actually not. No, he said drug companies. Drug companies don't care. The drug company doesn't care because they're gonna sell their pharmaceuticals whether the person's in the nursing home or not. That's a Washington. So, ma'am.
Don't want to get out or are afraid to get out.
Absolutely, no question. In some cases, the residents don't. Let me tell you some of the other places. The hospitals. You know, what happens, someone has a traumatic whatever, you know, they're in the hospital, what do you think, and the hospital's, you know, Medicare or whatever is going to stop, insurance is going to stop, what do you think they recommend, tell people to go? Nursing home. Nursing home. Not even necessarily rehab nursing. They want to get them out of the hospital. They want it because they're not going to get paid. They're not doing anything for them. So the hospital. Let me tell you who else is a major enemy of the hospital. Most nursing homes in this country are for profit. You know, they are major contributors. One big difference between for profit and not-for-profit. The for-profit are major contributors to the political elected officials. Right? This is a $75 billion a year business. Right? Do you ever expect a nursing home? Do you ever expect nursing homes to widespreadly tell people, you know, you should go in the community? There are waiver services for you. Right? And for every person who moves out, guess what that means, guys? Less money. They don't get the per diem under Medicaid for that person. So now we have not, Mark is right. We know when the 10th anniversary of Olmsted is. And as a result of approaching it, again adapt, push a number of people. And we have now brought, you know, a cases in a number of different states, you know, basically Olmsted nursing home lawsuits. They are plotting their way through. I'm not sure how successful they're going to be. But what about the other institution, the third institution that institutionalized people with disabilities? Guys, what is it? Well, that's a great one. She said personal care homes. It has become an institution. I was thinking about the state hospitals. In this room, we know the following. In this room, we know that there is no one in a MRDV institution who could not be adequately served in the community in a residential kind of program. I don't care what, you know, we can define it, but it doesn't have to be in an institution, right? And we can probably find totally mirror images of everyone in an institution living in a community and having a lot more fun and having a lot more integration. The same thing applies to people in nursing homes, right? You all know the person who had severe Alzheimer's with dementia and who lived at home, because his wife was never going to let him be institutionalized. Who was it, guys?
Ronald Reagan,
right? It wasn't even on her radar to institutionalize him. Why? Because enough money you can provide services for him at home, of course. And for people with mental illness, it is exactly the same thing, right? And we haven't taken that institution on, out of Olmsted, in anywhere near the degree that we should. But your point about the personal care homes is a really good one. One other thing, you know, I just sent out an information bulletin yesterday. You all, those of you on my infamous list will get it today or yesterday evening. I was shocked. There are 57,000 people in this country in nursing homes who have an MRDD diagnosis. That MRDD diagnosis occurred before age 22 and is going to last indefinitely. You know, it's one thing to put the label MRDD on someone who may have CP or blah, blah. These are people who, by and large, are the people who've been dumped out of group homes for the MRDD, who've been, whatever reason, you know, something happened in the state centers, and where have they wound up now? In the nursing home, right? This is, my time is running out, but there have been successes. If you look, I am not a naysayer. I always see this glass is half full. Let me tell you, when we started on Olmsted, Olmsted's most success has not been in terms of litigation. Its most success has been in organizing. When Olmsted was first brought, if you looked at just the nursing homes as an institution, throughout the country, 89% of the money, if you looked at long-term care expenditures, for people who could qualify for nursing, 89% went in the institutions. Only 11% went in the community. In 2007, that's been reduced to 69% in the institution and 31% in the community. You can say to me, Steve, you're still on 50-50. That's correct. But we have been doing that state by state. We've been doing that with little tugboats by organizing. And maybe in retrospect, you know, with a few good lawsuits in that context, we could have really pushed them even further. I have 5 minutes left. I promised I was going to stop and answer questions. So let me answer some questions. I cannot have scared you all. Yes?
Wait.
Get the mic, please.
I just wanted to add to Elizabeth, in my opinion, to nursing homes, on doctors and nurses. They scare the heck out of you.
Oh, they sure.
You will not be able to do this at home.
Right.
You'll be left alone. Your care will go down the hill. You'll die, whatever.
I'm in the 11th Circuit, literally a brief that was finished yesterday, that a gentleman had a stroke, 61-year-old gentleman, was in a nursing home for 3 or 4 years, and they were telling him, you need 24/7. And he said, wait a minute, all I need is help getting in and out of bed. It's all I get here. You know, 3, 4, 5 hours of the, no, you need 24/7. The doctor said, when he on his own, because of the Independent Living Center actually, found an apartment with a Section 8 voucher, and they threatened to discharge him against medical advice. He got in touch with us. He left. He convinced them not to do that. He left, got an apartment. Medicare paid for a short period of time, 4 hours a day, and he was paying $13 an hour out of his own money. He only has $900-some Social Security a month. $13 an hour for 4 hours a day is about $1,500. A month, right? Clearly cannot afford to continue paying. So we went to court on his behalf in Northern Florida, and we won that case. But the state's argument, this guy was out now for 3 months before we had the hearing, living on, the state's argument, they brought in his nursing home records, saying where the doctors and nurses saying he could not live in the community. He had been living in the community for 3 months, on 4 hours a day, you know, saving the state $3,000 or $4,000 a month difference in what he was paying versus, right? And that's what he wanted them to pay. But you're absolutely right. But just remember, you're a cash cow in the nursing home. Gentlemen?
Oh, I just wanted to follow up.
No, you're absolutely right.
I asked you about the housing.
Yeah.
There was a development going up by my area. It was 55 and older.
Let's talk at lunch.
Oh, okay.
I'm not going anywhere.
I just want to say, are they covered?
Well, it depends. Depends on two things. Okay, then it was a good question. I thought you had a personal question. They're covered if the housing received quote unquote federal financial assistance, which requires digging, a little digging. There's some kind of federal money that I would tell you to look out quickly, whether they received community development block grant, CDBG. Whether they received home investment partnership, many new developments did, and you can find that out, I can tell you at lunch how to. Or if they're not covered under the Section 504, when did the, you know, I would ask you, has it been built post-1991? And if the answer is yes, then they're covered under the Fair Housing Act, if a number, and we can talk at lunch. Gentlemen in the baseball hat.
It's a pit hat, by the way. Hi, Steve. It's Bill Christner. People with disabilities are cash cows because of Title 19 of the Social Security Act. And everybody in this room...
Title 19 is the Medicaid guy.
Right. And that's what created the system that pushes people into nursing facilities out of hospitals. And everybody in this room needs to call their congressmen and senators and tell them to support the Community Choice Act, which is going to be introduced on March 24th. Which will amend Title 19 and create a system of long-term care services and give people choices of where they get their services as opposed to now, where the only choice to get services is to go into the facility and or deal with waivers that waive the requirements of Title 19. So we have to pass the Community Choice Act this year, and then we're not a cash cow for nursing facilities.
Let me explain what Bill is saying in terms of, I'm sure most of you've heard of this act. But if you had a chip, and you said that this, and the chip was worth X dollars, and you could spend it in your community, in your apartment, or in a nursing home, that's called a choice. Right? Right now, you don't have that chip. Right now, the only place you can go and be sure of being accepted is an institution. Why do you think it's been so extraordinarily difficult to get Congress to amend the Medicaid statute so people would have a choice? This struggle began in 1993. Newt Gingrich sent me, Cassie James, Bob Kafka to the basement where this guy, who, well before Eileen Chin got me on the computers, was Mr. Computer for the house, and wrote that at night, one night, Mikasa, the predecessor to the Community Choice Act. Why do you think it's been introduced every year since 1993, that we still have a major uphill battle. Wilson can't win it. What?
Political contributions.
Political contributions. If you look at Senator Baucus and Senator Grassley, you know, the two people, they are big recipients of nursing home industry's PAC money, right? As is everybody else, right? The one thing that the nursing homes have that we do not have is money. Right? If we had that kind of money, we could be a pack and influence them, at least balance them. But it's, you know, someone asked me recently, you know, what do I think the chances are? God, man, that's one, I'm not putting any money down yet. Sir? This is the last question, Mr. Murphy told me.
We may not have a lot of money, but we do have a lot of numbers. And perhaps this question is actually a segue to this afternoon, but when the disability, you were talking about the opposition to the application of the Olmstead Act towards certain areas, and one of the things that I've noticed living where I live is there's a lot of people that may be part of the disabilities community that are against, for instance, community integration and the mental health end of things. Where do we start to build partnership when there is differences of opinion in the disabilities community about what qualifies you for the right of community integration?
Well, that's a terrific question, and I don't have an answer. But just posing the question is really important, because you know, when Mark was talking and talking about barriers, you know, the idea that we still have NIMBY, we have not, you know, part of the disability movement's objective, long term, is how do we change the culture so that the culture, our society, accepts the fact that this is a broad continuum, right? Some people are at this point, some people are at this point, but part of that changing the culture includes changing the culture of the disability community so that we understand that there are certain, you know, that there are certain principles that we all agree with. No one has spelled out those principles, right? That so that there could be a true cross-disability movement. It just doesn't exist. And the way the funding occurs, it perpetuates the AMR/DDDA and the APDDA, and et cetera, because every funding stream is totally separate. So we never even have to work together. Okay, thank you guys much. Have fun.